All right. Thank you. Thank you, Jorge, for opening today's service and for your introduction of me, and greetings to all of you. I'm in my home study here again in Port Townsend on this. It's the first day of the spring equinox, which began for us in the Pacific time zone just a couple of hours ago, 8:33 a.m., I've read. I do want to introduce my sermon theme for this morning, which is related, as I will explain in the sermon, to a personal event that took place last year at this time, just as spring was unfolding. My sermon is titled Death in Duel, D-U-A-L, and Dueling, D-U-E-L-I-N-G, Death in Duel and Dueling Perspectives. And I'm going to approach this subject as a kind of duel, D-U-E-L. So I'll be dividing my sermon into three parts, first presenting the two sides of the duel, followed thirdly by a way that the two sides might manage their tension. And so what I've done is to load most of the music for the service as well as the readings into this three-part sermon. And so the structure of the service is going to be a little bit different than usual. Before I go into that, Jorge, you're going to lead us in the sharing of joys and sorrows, and then immediately after that, I'll begin the three-part sermon. Well into my 75th year here on planet Earth, and death is increasingly an abiding presence. It's always been there in the background, sometimes in the foreground, but increasingly I live with it as a foreground experience, daily measuring and weighing things quite consciously within this framework. Now, in part, this increased consciousness is related to my wife Flossie's encounter with ovarian cancer at just this time this past year. We learned of her cancer, which was well advanced, on March the 1st last year, just as we were moving into spring. And we didn't know at that time whether death might be weeks or months away. Fortunately, through the advances in modern medicine and with the assistance of some very fine medical personnel, Flossie was able to have major surgery. That was on March 23rd this past year, followed by several months of chemotherapy and continuing today with maintenance drugs. But because of this, more time has been vouchsafed to her and to us. And so springtime did come for us just somewhat later than it was posted on the calendar last year. But what I've decided to do this morning is to share with you some of my more recent thoughts and understandings in approaching personal death, which, as I say, Flossie and I faced very directly this past year. And my approach to personal death is essentially twofold in nature, and based on the approach of depth psychologist Carl Jung's notion of there being two centers of the human psyche, a smaller center, which has to do with ego consciousness, and then a deeper, larger center, which has to do with cosmic consciousness. Along this line, a few years ago, a little book titled My Stroke of Insight came my way. And this has been helpful for me in organizing my thoughts around death. I'm going to hold that book up. It's just a thin little book, My Stroke of Insight. It was written by Dr. Jill Bolte Taylor. She's a neuroanatomist for a number of years, taught and did research at the Harvard Medical School. And here's the brief story of how Dr. Taylor came to look at death in these dual and dueling perspectives. While she was a researcher at the Harvard Medical School, on December 10, 1996, Dr. Taylor, she was just a woman, only 37 years old, experienced a massive stroke in the left hemisphere of her brain. And what Dr. Taylor knew about before intellectually, she now experienced during her stroke. She knew that the left hemisphere of the brain is the center of personal identity, the ego center, as she names it, which knows time, past and future. It makes distinctions, passes judgment, and it experiences fear, threat, loss, and so forth. And when a blood vessel in this part of her brain hemorrhaged, and started to close down the functioning of her left brain to go offline, as it were, she began to experience her personal identity slipping away. But strangely, it didn't bother her so much because now she began also to experience more fully how her right brain functioned. And her right brain, she found, is timeless, dwells in the present only, and is oceanic and fluid in its feel. The right brain, she discovered, experiences itself as one with all that is, a part of the endless flow of infinite being. And thus, as Dr. Taylor experienced, the two hemispheres of our brain apparently have different approaches to the question of death. When people say, for example, when you're dead, that's it, kaput, they are speaking from the perspective of the left hemisphere of the brain. The right hemisphere, however, has a very different story to tell, namely, that we are one with everything that is, and there is really no such thing as death, for everything is all of one piece. Dr. Taylor puts it this way in her book. She says, my left mind thinks of me as a fragile individual capable of losing my life. My right mind realizes that the essence of my being has eternal life. And for Dr. Taylor, we are paradoxically both at once, or again, as she puts it, I am simultaneously capable of being at one with the universe while having an individual identity. So let's look more closely at these perspectives on personal death, and we'll begin with the ego's perspective on death. Following the approach of depth psychologist Carl Jung and his students, the ego may be described as that part of the human psyche that has to do with our capacity to be self-aware or self-conscious. A Jungian author, Robert A. Johnson, for example, speaks of the ego as the organ of self-consciousness or the organ of self-awareness. As the organ of self-awareness, the ego comes into existence by way of the evolutionary development of the neocortex in the forefront of our brain, manifesting itself in members of our species at around the age of 2, for it's at that time that we begin to have the conscious sense of being an individual and of having a personal identity. It's also at that age that we start using that magical word, I. And I actually watched this process occur with my own children. That was about 40 years ago. It's because we have an ego that we use the word I, and correspondingly, the use of the word I is a manifestation or demonstration of the presence of an ego. Thus, it's through the ego, as that part of the psyche that has to do with self-identity and self-consciousness, that we experience and suffer loss and its accompanying emotions. This experience of loss is related to perceived threats, injuries, and defeats to our self-identity, our self-image, to who we think we are, to what we think we believe, to who we are connected to, and so forth. All creatures, it would seem, have laid deep within them the instinct to preserve and to develop themselves. It's the threefold urge, as philosopher Alfred North Whitehead has put it, to live well, and to live better. All creatures seek life, resist death. But no other creature, from what we can observe, seems to experience the prospect of individual death as the psychological blow to their self-identity, like we human beings do. Certain developed creatures may seem headed in that direction, but certainly with us, the awareness of death brings with it huge amounts of anticipatory anxiety, and then in actual loss, immense amounts of sorrow, grief, anger, despair, and so forth. I wonder if your experience is the same as mine in regard to considering my own death. Can one really imagine one's own death? I've tried, and I find I really can't imagine it. How can you imagine the end of your own identity? As long as you're aware and thinking and considering things, your identity is intact. And so my experience is that one really can't imagine the dissolution of one's own consciousness, because such imagination requires self-consciousness. And so it seems to me that the ego, this organ of self-consciousness, cannot really imagine its own extinction. Or another angle on this: when you try to imagine your own death, what you get is nothingness. From the perspective of the ego, death is nothingness. So long as the ego is attached to its own processes, which is that of personal identity, then death, which involves the dissolution of the ego, means extinction, means nothingness. This perspective is represented in an essay that came my way a couple of months ago from someone who is part of the congregation here in Port Townsend. The essay is titled, "A Personal Perspective of Life and Death," and it's written by Quentin Wald. He's 101 years old, and he has obviously had a longer time than most to consider these matters. So I'm going to end the first part of this sermon by quoting several paragraphs from this essay that came my way. And George, could you put up that first slide? Thank you. Quentin writes, "From the vantage point of my present age, it appears to me to be impossible for a young person to perceive the idea of death with any full realization. The sense of life is too pressing, and mortality is only theoretical for the young." Next. "Only when it becomes obvious that not enough time remains to enjoy experiences or accomplishments long planned or hoped for does the sense of mortality become imminent. First of all, I am certain death is the onset of non-existence. Since death is nothingness, it is nothing to fear. The difficulty is in giving up life. Each human consciousness is a whole universe in its conception of the world, of the society in which it moves, and in its knowledge, its memories, and its relation to other beings. When it dies, a whole universe of marvelous complexity collapses and is destroyed. As a child's swarm of soap bubbles drifts among the trees, each one a perfect sphere of evanescent colors, so is each human consciousness. But then, on touching a leaf or a twig, the bubble silently collapses, leaving only a little wet spot which quickly evaporates. Thus is a life ended and remembered briefly by a few, and very soon, not at all." He continues, "I regard ideas of immortality or of any sort of personal continuation beyond death as a common and, in fact, rather childish illusion, which is a consequence of the impossibility of imagining non-existence and of the will to life, which is so strongly inculcated in every animal by the evolutionary struggle for survival. When higher brain function is immobilized in deep anesthesia or even in deep sleep, there is no awareness. How then can it be otherwise when that 2 pounds of pink and gray mush ceases to function or is totally destroyed? It is pretty well established that memory is stored in the pattern of neuronal connections. Since this ceases to exist when the brain disintegrates, a soul persisting beyond death would have no memory of this life. on persisting into a future life, it would be at most only the raw material for a new individual consciousness and could scarcely be considered a continuation of the present individual in any meaningful sense. It may also be observed that there is no continuity of self into the past before conception. By simple symmetry, one would expect none after death. On these somber notes, let's take our first musical break, and we're going to listen to a song titled "And When I Die." It's performed by the jazz rock group Blood, Sweat, and Tears. So this song speaks of the ego's confrontation with death and its sense of death as extinction, of being dead, dead, and gone, and of the wish, while alive, to live free, and when dying comes, to go naturally. But this song also speaks of a certain continuity in life, namely the sense that life is passed from generation to generation. As we heard in the words, "And when I die, and when I'm dead, dead and gone, there'll be one child born in a world to carry on. And actually, in the original lyrics by songwriter and singer Laura Nyro, the beginning words of the song are, "And when I die, and when I'm dead, dead and gone, there'll be one child born and a world to carry on. Those are words I actually like better, in which the folk musical group Peter, Paul, and Mary used in their rendering of the song. But at any rate, these words speak of the ego identifying not just with its own individual being and processes, but also identifying with ongoing life and being beyond itself. And so now, following this lead, and following the lead of Dr. Taylor, let's cross over the thick mass of connecting cords from the left side of the brain. That mass of connecting tissues is called the corpus callosum. Let's take that bridge and cross over to the right hemisphere of our brain to get its perspective on personal death. And as I mentioned earlier, the right hemisphere has a very different story to tell, namely that we are one with everything that is, and there really is no such thing as death, only the one ongoing reality that goes through its multiple changes, or as the mystic poet Walt Whitman has put it, all goes onward and outward, nothing collapses, and to die is different from what anyone supposed, and luckier. And so the ego may not be able to imagine the end of its own consciousness, but what it can experience and what it can identify with is life beyond its own life and being beyond its own being. Indeed, it can identify not only with the next generation, not only with the single child being born, but it can identify with what has been called cosmic consciousness. And so let's turn to that perspective on death. And a cosmic consciousness, as I regard it, brings in the mystical dimension of reality, in which one both conceives of and experiences that indeed all things are of one piece. It's the mental awareness, and it's the felt experience and knowledge of an identity that transcends one's individual identity, in which one sees and feels and knows oneself to be part of a universal, ongoing cosmic flow. In mystical approaches, an identity is implied between subject and object, which is to say that from this perspective, ultimately, there is no subject and there is no object. The barrier between the two is withdrawn so that the two are seen as one reality. We are one before we are two. In mystical experience, from the one side, it is subtraction, that is to say, the dissolving of the distinctions between things, the blurring of the boundaries between things, and from the other side, it is addition, the positive recognition and felt experience of a fundamental unity and identity of all that is. "Erase the lines," cries the poet Robinson Jeffers. "I pray you not to love classifications." The thing, he says, is like a river from source to seamouth, one flowing life. And thus, mystical experience has to do with an experience of an essential identity of things beneath and beyond their surface differences. And it would seem, as Dr. Taylor experienced, that the right hemisphere of the brain is the part of the brain that is more connected to the unity and oneness of things. And I would also connect this with what depth psychologist Carl Jung and his followers have named the self with a capital S. The self, as the Jungians speak of it, refers to the larger, deeper, transpersonal center of our psychological structure, and from which the personal center, the ego, emerges, with the ego continually visited and informed by the larger center by means of drives, impulses, inspirations, dreams, visions, and so forth. Now, I don't say that there is an absolute one-to-one correspondence between the right hemisphere of the brain and what the Jungians named the self, or a one-to-one correspondence of the left hemisphere of the brain and the ego. But in a general way, I think we can say that the right hemisphere of our brain is connected to our sense of being related to that which is transpersonal, to that which is greater than any individual identity and being. And so the self, the larger and deeper center of our human psyche, is that part of our being that is connected to the center of being itself, to nature, to creativity, to God, to that which is beyond naming, and at the same time to that which has names without number. Find the language, find the term and terms that work for you. And whereas the ego experiences loss and suffering as it focuses on maintaining and protecting itself, it can also open itself to the deeper center of the psyche, to the larger self, which sees itself as part of cosmic consciousness and thus transcends loss and suffering and rolls on and on and on and on. So let's go to our second musical interlude and listen to a hymn. It's from our teal-colored hymnal. It's titled The Oneness of Everything. It's composed by Jim Scott, and it's sung here by Harmony Rutter and Leroy Davidson, accompanying her on the organ. They're both from the Olympic Unitarian Universalist Fellowship in Sequim, Port Angeles. I thank them for permission to use this piece, along with Sandy Goodwick from their fellowship, who has put together the video production. So, George, could you bring that up for us, please? So, I've spoken now of two perspectives on personal death, both of which are wired into our brains, capacities for both ego consciousness and cosmic consciousness. So how do we live with these two often competing perspectives? Can we relate them? How do we relate them? Here's a quotation from Jungian author John A. Sanford on the relationship of the ego to the larger self. And George, if I could have that slide. John Sanford writes, "But the ego as we know it is but a passing phenomenon. The true reality is the soul, or in psychological language, the expression of the self. The task of the ego is to accumulate consciousness and to be willing to die when its time comes. Thus, the ego is important, but not the most important thing. Anything less than this turns religion into another form of egocentricity." And secondly, in relating these, let's turn to a little poem. It was the one that was presented on a slide at the very beginning of the service. And to me, it's a poem that speaks of the distinction, relationship, and partnership of the ego to the self. It's titled, "I Am Not I." It's by Juan Ramon Jimenez, translated by Robert Bly, and it makes a distinction between what I would call the little I and the larger I. Here's the poem. I am not I. I am this one walking beside me, whom I do not see, whom at times I manage to visit and whom at other times I forget. The one who remains silent when I talk. The one who forgives sweet when I hate. The one who takes a walk where I am not. The one who will remain standing when I die. And to emphasize the distinction between the little I and the larger I, here's how I would present the poem using the uppercase and lowercase in the text where appropriate. So, George, could you show that slide? I am not I, lowercase. I, uppercase, am this one walking beside me, whom I do not see, whom at times I manage to visit, and whom at other times I forget. The one who remains silent when I talk. The one who forgives sweet when I hate. The one who takes a walk where I am not. The one who will remain standing when I die. So these quotes speak to me of the relation of the ego, the little I, to the self, the larger I. But just because we speak of the ego as the smaller center of the psyche or the little I doesn't mean it's unimportant. As John Sanford said in that quote I gave you a couple of minutes ago, the ego is important. It's just not the most important thing. And I might even put it a little bit more strongly than that, namely, that the ego is hugely important. It's the most distinctive feature of our species. It's the level at which we live most of our lives. And beyond this, without ego consciousness, we would not be consciously aware of cosmic consciousness. And so we do ourselves no favor by attempting to ignore, dismiss, or denigrate the ego. And so I like to speak of giving the ego its rights, giving the ego its rights. That is to say, to allow, even more than that, to encourage, actually, the ego to express its anxiety, distress, its hurt, its weakness, its sorrow, its grief in the face of loss and death and in the face of its own disillusion. The first thing, for example, that I typically try to do in memorial services at which I officiate is to acknowledge the loss, not miss that step of grief, not try to be strong in the face of death, nor to try to move immediately to the cosmic or to the eternal, but first of all, to allow ourselves, that is our ego selves, to allow it to feel the pain of loss, the distress of regret, and to let ourselves, if need be drenched by sorrow. When sorrow comes, says the Reverend A. Powell Davies, let us accept it simply as a part of life. Let the heart be open to pain. Let it be stretched by it. All the evidence we have says that this is the better way. And so by allowing our ego self, its place, its emotions, its fears, its sadness, its grief, we're in a position then to open in a posture of surrender to the larger self and to its connection to cosmic consciousness. And so granting the ego its place, how do we relate and connect it to the deeper center of our psyche, the self? How do we relate the smaller I to the larger I? And so let me ask you, how do you connect your limited and finite being to infinite being? How do you calm yourself? How do you settle yourself? How do you regain your balance when you and your ego consciousness feel absolutely overwhelmed and at the end of your tether? There are, of course, multiple methods and techniques. There are multiple spiritual paths and disciplines for settling the ego down, for assisting it in opening up and connecting to the larger reality beyond itself. And I can mention things like meditation, prayer, the practice of yoga or the practice of the rosary. I can mention journaling or dream work or reading or listening to playing music. I can mention singing and dancing and walking and running, swimming, sailing, watching the ocean waves, gardening, golfing. I would not want to limit the possibilities. For myself, as for many others, being out in nature is an aid in knowing my place and finding my proper place in the larger scheme of things. The odd comfort, perhaps you have felt it at times, in the experience of your finiteness and littleness in relation to the larger reality of nature. As this is the kind of experience I've had, for example, in visiting the Grand Canyon in Arizona, the immensity of that place, feeling the vastness of time and the layers of stone that are piled one on top of the other that have been deposited over the millennia. You yourself might one day be a tiny particle in such a layer of stone. And in one sense, it absolutely wipes you out. And yet in another sense, as you behold its grandeur and its beauty, how can you raise a complaint? It's okay. It's okay. It's more than okay. About 3 weeks ago, I returned from being out in the deserts of the Southwest, where I had the nightly opportunity to stand under the immensity of the night sky and watch the stars as they, from our perspective, revolve around the pole star, the North Star, which is the end star of the handle of the Little Dipper. And so night after night, I had that privilege of watching the Big Dipper come into view over the Santa Rosa Mountains and then rotate counterclockwise around the North Star, around the Pole Star. It's an experience that takes you out of your normal human world, and nothing against that world. The balance is needed, which I find in that experience. Here's a concluding poem by the mystic poet Walt Whitman. And George, could you put that up on the screen? When I heard the learned astronomer, when the proofs, the figures were ranged in columns before me, when I was shown the charts and the diagrams to add, divide, and measure them, when I, sitting, heard the astronomer where he lectured with much applause in the lecture room, how soon, unaccountable, I became tired and sick, till rising and gliding out, I wandered off by myself in the mystical, moist night air, and from time to time, looked up in perfect silence at the stars. To conclude the sermon, we're going to listen to Whitman's poem, Put to Music. George, as we conclude today's service, I'd like to thank our celebrant, Jorge Manzanera, who is coming to us from Point Roberts, for assisting so ably in the service. And also, of course, our behind-the-scenes media technician, George Rogers Clark, for bringing in the readings and music at their appointed times. Thank you, George. And also, again, of course, to program director Sally Riggers for her role in setting up this service. Thank you all. I look forward, actually, to being with you, perhaps in person, on Easter Sunday, which is April 17. Our closing words are from the author Wendell Berry, environmentalist, and these will be followed by the extinguishing of the chalice by Jorge. Wendell Berry writes, "We clasp the hands of those who go before us and the hands of those who come after us. We enter the little circle of each other's arms, and the larger circle of lovers whose hands are joined in a dance, and the larger circle of all creatures passing in and out of life, who move also in a dance to a music so subtle and vast that no ear hears it except in fragments.